British Public Radio. Travel.
Travel Bites, in association with discovernorthernireland.com. Holiday right here at home this summer.
Hello there, my name's David Gordon, and you're very welcome to Travel Bites. In this episode, we visit the cathedral city of Armagh. We also hear about the country of Morocco. We visit Kyoto in Japan. And we go to Hollywood, California. That's all coming up in this episode of Travel Bites. We're standing here in the rather grand surroundings of the Palace Stables here in Armagh. What's the history of this particular part of the city?
Well, Armagh is a very significant place. It's the ancient cathedral city of Ireland. So St. Patrick, he came to Armagh and founded his first great church here. And it's also one of the oldest cities in Ireland, so as you can imagine, there's sort of a lot of... It's steeped in history and heritage.
It's one of the things, as you're driving in, you can see the two cathedrals, which is always something nice, and you can visit them as well, can't you?
Oh, yeah, you can. We're actually the only city in the world to have two cathedrals dedicated to the one saint. So we have two cathedrals dedicated to St. Patrick's. They do guided tours of the cathedrals, so you just come along to cathedrals and book your tour. And the people up at the cathedrals are really knowledgeable, and as I say, they'll talk you through the history. In the Church of Ireland Cathedral, you can see a direct link back to St. Patrick. You know, there's fantastic things to do up there as well.
Now, going back a wee bit further in time, you've also got things in the region like Navan Fort. What's Navan all about?
Navan is an ancient pagan settlement. It was sort of the ancient seat of the High Kings of Ulster. So if you go out to Navan, you can visit the fort, and if you can go to the centre. There's an interpretive centre. So they take you through sort of all the myths and legends of the Ulster cycle. So there's loads of great stories out in Navan as well.
It's actually a bit of an interesting destination, Armagh, because you've got the religious side, mm-hmm. but you've also got the scientific, with the planetarium here as well.
Yeah, we have the planetarium and the Armagh Observatory as well. So the planetarium is Ireland's only planetarium. It has a full 3D digital dome, so it's a fantastic day out and you can learn loads up there. And it's as well as learning loads, it's great fun too, so it is.
The thing about Armagh, it's quite a compact city, so it's also good for shopping and eating out too.
Oh yes, fantastic, and we have some fantastic restaurants here and really high quality independent boutique shops, and a few high street names as well. Everything is within walking distance, so as I said earlier, it's Ireland's oldest city, but it's also Ireland's smallest city, so again you can park up and everything's within walking distance, so it makes for a fantastic day out.
What about people who want to maybe come and explore the region for a couple of days? What about accommodation?
Yeah, we have great accommodation here. We have two hotels and we have numerous B&Bs. We also have sort of a few more unusual places to stay. We have Teepee Valley. So it's sort of like glamping. You can stay in a teepee or a gypsy caravan, or, you know, there's sort of a few alternatives. So it's fantastic. We also have Clare Glen Caravan Park, so it's a 4-star caravan park, so people that are interested in sort of holidays with the caravans, there's options here as well, and they're located around the forests outside Armagh. So.
If people want to find out more, what's the best website they can look at?
The website is www.armagh.co.uk, or you can contact the Tourist Information Centre on 028 3752 1800.
We're sitting here in the very nice surroundings beside a big roaring fire at Uluru Restaurant, I hope I pronounced that right as well, in Armagh. It's actually a little bit of Australia in the city, isn't it?
Yeah, well, when we first opened, we sort of wanted to create a restaurant that felt very much like home, and I guess keeping the heat at around 30 degrees is one of those key factors, but no, it's very laid-back, sort of casual dining, and that's sort of the way we come across, and that's the style of food that we would do in Australia as well.
Now, it is an Australian restaurant, and there's something on the menu that isn't normally in the menu in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, we've got a little bit of kangaroo on. We put it on originally just as a bit of a gimmick, I mean, but I think the people of Northern Ireland really like their game, so the venison and wood pigeon, that sort of thing, so they've really taken to it, and we actually have regulars who come in for the kangaroo now, do about 80 to 120 kangaroo steaks a week, so it's very popular.
And of course, you don't grow kangaroos locally.
No, I tried to, but they're a bit too quick and it's a bit too cold outside. So everything we have, we would source through Australia. Comes in through a meat supplier in the south. Australian wildlife, there's a cull that we would have in Australia. It's not roadkill or anything like that. It's certainly stamped and sort of all verified. But it is a long process to get it here, but it's worth it in the long run.
Now, you mentioned the fact that in Northern Ireland it's very much a game meat type of place. What do you see people now going for game more than traditional steak?
Well, the thing is that every restaurant does a little bit of steak and a little bit of chicken. We would say we're an Australian restaurant in that we would use a lot of the cooking techniques that we would use in Australia, and also that Pan-Pacific belt. So there's a lot of fusion food. We do soft-shell crab and we do a lot of different things. But yeah, it's really going towards, with the cooking shows, the way people are sort of perceiving food is they're being a lot more adventurous. We've got goat come on the menu now, and it's actually through a Northern Irish supplier, but we're cooking how we would cook a lamb shoulder, and that's pot roasted, rolled, and it just falls apart. So I guess it's the cooking techniques more than just the food itself as well.
Now, the other produce that you serve is all locally found, isn't it?
Yeah, we're a big believer in sort of knowing where our food comes from. We've been open now 7 years, and we now have a good sort of chain of suppliers. And I've got a guy, for instance, who's got his own fishing boat. So he'll call me on a Thursday night and on a Monday night, because he's up here on a Tuesday and a Friday, and he'll say, right, today I've got scallops and I've got fresh hake or some salmon. And we change our menu according to what he can get. We've also got on board recently a local cider company. So rather than the big sort of corporate branding, we're going more with the microbreweries. And I think people are liking that a lot more. You know, they're sick and tired of the domestic sort of beer. You know, I'm not going to say any names, but they want to support local people, and I guess that's where it's all coming from. We grow a lot of our own fruit and veg too. We've got a polytunnel, and we spend, you know, well, when we have nice weather, which is only a couple of weeks a year, but we try and grow as much as we can, you know. So that's knowing where our food comes from is very important, not only to us but to our customers. So I think we have to be key on that at the moment as well.
Do you find a lot of customers are now coming to you specifically for the likes of the kangaroo and the game?
We do get people travelling from far and wide now. We've won a few awards, and I think everybody knows an Australian, or there might be somebody who's married, you know, into the family, and they'll tend to bring their Australian family to us because they can also get VB and sort of Crown Lager and the Australian beers. We've got a all-Australian and all-New Zealand wine list, so you won't find any Chilean or Italian or French on my wine list. A lot of people sort of at the start complained about that because French is the best, but I don't know French wine. I know Australian wine and I know New Zealand wine, and that's the wine that I grew up with, and that's the wine that I've learned to match my food with. So that's sort of the way we've done it. But yeah, there's a lot of people who are sort of would bring the family in, and people at the moment, out of a table of four, there will always be somebody, don't get me wrong, who'll have a well-done steak with chips and pepper sauce, and we can do that for you. That's no worries. We have that on the menu. But then out of that table of four, you might get two people take a little bit of kangaroo, and one will take some venison or soft-shell crab, or, you know, so people are being more adventurous, but you've got to cater for everybody, and I think that's the key at the moment. Don't exclude anybody just because, you know, your chef's ego or you want to do what you want to do, because at the moment, the customer is king. So you've got to sort of have everything on the menu for everybody. Everybody's welcome.
Of course, I should ask the name in general. Where did the name come from?
Well, the name is actually Aboriginal for Ayers Rock, and it's sort of a homage to where I came from. I grew up in a small little town up on the east coast, and I grew up with a lot of Aboriginal and Islanders. And growing up, I learned a lot about their culture. And I guess it was, we were trying to come up with a name that was synonymous with Australia, which sort of, you know, people would recognise. And if you've ever seen the rock over the sort of over the day, it's bright orange in the morning, and then after lunchtime it goes red, and then at night time it goes a purple sort of hazy colour. And I guess it's similar with the restaurant. We change with the seasons as well. I mean, during the summertime it's light and airy, and we have window boxes, and You can smell the coriander and that sort of stuff. And in wintertime, we close it in. We've got the fire lit, and it's a real warm and cozy feeling. And I guess we wanted to change like the rock does over the day. So that was sort of the idea behind it.
You're listening to Travel Bites. You can find us online at travelbitesradio.podbean.com and also on iTunes. As you know by now, we're linked with Around the World Radio, which is based in Santa Barbara, California. And in our last episode, the host Arthur von Wiesenberger took us to Tokyo. He now continues that journey as we visit Kyoto.
It's the Arthur and Dawn show here on Around the World. We are piloting our way across the globe, and first stop is back to Asia. Last week we were in Tokyo on an amazing adventure through the capital. Now we're going to what was the former capital of Japan for many, many years. Emperor was there. Kyoto, which is an ancient city south of Tokyo.
So given these were on the same trip, how long does it take to get to Tokyo to Kyoto, and how do you get there?
Depends how you do it.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to show you the best way to get there, because that's what we try to do on Around the World, show you the best way to travel. Let's go to the video.
Kyoto is a city of history, mystery, and revelation. It was Japan's capital and the emperor's residence from 794 until 1868. Osaka is the nearest airport to Kyoto, but if you're traveling from Tokyo, the fastest way there is by train.
Shinkansen or bullet train, which links many cities in Japan. This one is going from Tokyo to Osaka, and it goes about 300 kilometers an hour, or about 190 miles an hour. Very quiet, very comfortable, extremely well insulated, and this is the cabin where most people are just sleeping. There was some food being served on board earlier, which is a bento box. Not bad. Anyway, 2.5 hours from Tokyo to Kyoto. Mumi is a small and charming boutique hotel sequestered in the Gion district of Kyoto along the peaceful Shirakawa River. The hotel has only 7 rooms, but each has a unique Japanese style with antique furniture, some with tatami bedrooms, and all with top technology.
Oh, we're back. Thank you.
On a hot Kyoto day, nothing was more refreshing than an ice-cold ginger drink and a cool, air-conditioned hotel. Breakfast is especially impressive at Mumi, with fresh soup, mixed fresh fruits, yogurt, boiled egg, cappuccino, croissants. You know, there's enough temptation to lure one out of their cozy bedrooms. It was time to start seeing some of Kyoto's sights, and Mumi secured a great driver and guide. Symbolic of Kyoto is Kinkakuji, the Golden Pavilion, a Zen temple in northern Kyoto. Perhaps one of the most famous buildings in all of Japan, and whether in the winter or summer, its golden reflection shimmering in the pond before it is awe-inspiring. The original 14th century temple was torched by one of the temple's monks. Most recently rebuilt in 1955, with all its gold leaf splendor, the inside rooms are rarely open for visitors. One exception was when President George W. Bush visited Kyoto on November 16, 2005. He had a first-hand view of the interior, which is also covered in gold leaf. The gardens are traditional Japanese style, with some remarkable specimens, such as a 600-year-old bonsai tree.
lights up show the ocean or sea. Ocean. The stone is island. And the stone is a total is 15 stone.
Once the shoes are off, you can enter the Ryoan-ji Temple, where one can see the finest examples of a Zen rock garden in the country. No one knows who designed it or what the meaning is. There are 15 rocks, but at no time can you see all 15 at the same time, no matter where one sits. They say, though, you can see the missing rocks through meditation, in the mind's eye. Located within the fortification of a wall and a moat is the original Nijo Castle. Originally built in 1626, it was struck by lightning in 1750 and burned to the ground, and then rebuilt. The floors are called nightingale floors because they make a chirping sound when walked upon. They were used as a security device.
Arigato. Say something in English. Hello, America.
Hello.
Hello.
America.
America.
Yeah, very good. Good. Very good. All right.
Gion Kappa is a fun, casual restaurant where one can sit at a counter which surrounds the kitchen on three sides. Food is prepared in front of you, and the chefs hand you the dishes. Just about everything on the menu is 390 yen, or about $4. Very reasonable by Japanese standards. And the place is filled with locals. Sushi, tempura, and yakitori are popular. The yadofu, or cold tofu, was especially good in the warm summer night. Cold sake also hit the spot.
Okay, my cup run is over.
In Japan, Buddhist temples and Shinto shrines coexist, sometimes right next to one another. Many temples and shrines are at the top of a long stairway. Some say that the number of stairs corresponds with the number of human desires, and walking up the stairs is a philosophical exercise to extinguish those desires. At the top is a purification fountain. Here one takes a ladle, fills it with fresh water, and then rinses both hands. One is also supposed to rinse the mouth with water poured from the ladle into the hand. Tea ceremony in Kyoto is a taste of Zen rituals. At Ien, a small tea house down a hidden alleyway in the Gion district, one can witness the precise movements from the cleaning of the tea utensils to frothing the bitter green tea with a whisk to the clockwise turns of the cup before you sip. The kimono-clad server speaks excellent English, and the experience is a taste of true Kyoto tradition. The most famous geisha district in the world is Gion. Old wooden buildings that house tea houses and exclusive Japanese restaurants is where the geishas entertain their customers, often at a price of up to $1,000. But geishas are not call girls. The geisha entertains her customers with music, stories, and games. If you're lucky, you might catch a glimpse of a geisha walking between tea houses in their zori sandals and in amazing kimonos. Tourists are quick to try and snap a picture in the dim evening light, but geishas are camera shy and dodge the paparazzi. But the cards fell in my favor on a second night of a geisha quest. One suddenly appeared out of the darkness and walked directly by my rolling video camera. Domo arigato, Kyoto.
You're listening to Travel Bites. My name's David Gordon, and for a little bit of a change, we're going, to Africa. We're going to Morocco, and on the other end of the line should be Rosina McKeown, who's originally from Hollywood but now living in Marrakesh. Hi, Rosina, how are you?
Hi, David. Great, thank you.
Tell me this, first of all, for the people who maybe don't quite know where Morocco is, where is it in Africa?
Well, we're in the north coast of Africa, in the northwest, so we've got a really long coastline. Right, sort of about 3,000 kilometers of coastline. So that we're the top of Morocco is facing into the Mediterranean, and then we've got a big Atlantic coast down our side coast, down our western coast. So we've a lot of very nice beaches.
Now, for a first-time visitor to the country, what sort of culture can they expect there?
Well, a very diverse one. It depends where you go in the country. I mean, most people are flying into Marrakesh, and when you arrive into Marrakesh, you've got a lot of options. You can enjoy the city, which is very diverse, with a very old culture, with the old souks and the old medinas. You would imagine a lot of beautiful palaces and museums dating back from the 12th century. But within an hour, you can be in the Atlas Mountains, and within 2 hours or 2.5 hours, you can be in some really nice coastal towns, which have a good mix of, you know, touristic facilities like lovely beaches, surfing options and all of that, as well as, you know, keeping the historical element with some nice old souks and old medinas and museums and things.
What about food? What's the traditional food you can get in Morocco?
Well, I mean, they're very big on barbecue and all the grilled meats and things, which are very popular, but I suppose it's best known for its couscous and tagines. And one of the little known things, actually, that they're really great at, which people, Irish people and British people tend to love, is they do a really mean slow roast lamb. So that's something that Jamie Oliver did whenever he was out here, and that's a very popular dish here. So that's something I know that people from home always really enjoy when they're here.
So you can go to, sometimes you go to different countries and you're horrified at the sort of things that people put down in front of you, but most of the stuff you would be able to eat, it would be for our palate.
Well, you know, as my mum says when she visits, David, you know, a tagine is really just an Irish stew, really, you know, but it's meat in a sauce with other vegetables and things. So it's really not very alien for us at all. The slow roast lamb is something very popular, and barbecue sausages, even though their sausages are made of lamb, not of pork. The couscous, I suppose, is the thing that's most different perhaps from our culture, but I think, you know, a lot of the big supermarkets and couscous is very popular all over now, so I think people are quite used to it, but it doesn't taste as good as it does here.
Now, the other big thing, of course, when people go on holiday somewhere is where you stay. And I've been looking at your Boutique Souk website, and it really surprised me, because, I mean, you have some places on your website that you can stay for €60 a night for two people.
Yes, I mean, it's a really broad range. I mean, there are obviously some amazing palace and five-star hotels here, but there is, you know, quite accessible accommodation for boutique style hotels. I mean, there are larger package holidays and things like that, but we specialize in finding really interesting little properties. And the riads, which are the old courtyard houses, which have all been converted, or many of them have been converted in the old city into little boutique hotels, which I suppose are the equivalent of what we would know as B&Bs and guest houses in Ireland. And you can stay there. They might only have 3 or 4 rooms, 5 rooms. So it's a very personalised individual service that you'll have from the teams there, and a very warm welcome. So that's what we really recommend for your first time in Marrakesh, is to stay in one of those properties, get to know the local staff instead of being in something larger and impersonal, and also to be right in the middle of the old city so that you can quickly get out and about and discover the souks.
So you could virtually live with people in their own houses then?
Well, you know, these houses are staffed, and you have, you know, nearly quite often you have owner managers on site, and they can be of all sorts of nationalities. You have a lot of French and Italian people running them, but the places that we recommend and we put people into are all have English speaking teams and English speaking managers and things. So it's very welcoming, and you get a good insight into the local culture with a lot of lovely comforts. I mean, the decoration and the styling of these properties are really individual and not like anything you'll get anywhere else in the world.
Now, what about places to see? If you were able to go, would you suggest a long weekend or a couple of weeks? What's the best thing to do?
Well, it depends how much time you have. I mean, you can do a lot in a long weekend, and what we recommend is that if you have a week or longer, that you stay a few days in Marrakesh and really discover what the city has to offer, and then perhaps do a couple of nights in the Atlas Mountains and then a few days at the coast. If you have a week, you can pack a lot in. That's one of our most popular trips. In fact, it's 3 days Marrakesh, 2 days in the mountains and 3 days at the coast. So within that week, you can do a lot. And when in Marrakesh, you've lots of museums, you've lots of souking and shopping and visiting the square and all of that. You've got, you know, a lot of really beautiful architecture and interiors, but you've also got really fun nightlife. So, you know, there's everything from discovering, you know, the handcraft merchants in the middle of the souks, right to going to Passion Nightclub if you want to do it. So there's a little bit of everything. There's amazing spas. The traditional hammam is a very fantastic treatment where you're put in a warm room and scrub from top to bottom and coming out with sort of baby soft skin and great massage and all of that. So there's really quite a range of activities to do. We've got fantastic golf courses here and great restaurants, a real mix of restaurants, everything from, you know, sort of quiet romantic little riads to, you know, big fun gastronomic restaurants with lots of live entertainment and even belly dancers.
What's a good time of year to visit? I would assume, being Africa, it's probably going to get very, very warm in the summertime.
Yes, I mean, I have to say, we wouldn't be recommending Marrakesh July, August, which is, you know, in Northern Ireland, it's a typical holiday time, perhaps over July, etc. But any time the rest of the year is very good. You know, we have sunshine all year round. Today it was in the 20s, which is like a very good day at home. And this is our winter. So the only difference here is that in the winter time, as it is now, it'll still be very warm and sunny during the day, but it's cold at night. And so you need a coat for going out in the evenings, but you can still be sunbathing by the pool during the day. Very popular times would be Easter time, May, you know, through to early summer. And then again in the autumn, it's very popular. September, October through to November, we've got really great temperatures. And Marrakesh is a really good alternative to Europe, which by that time, even the south of Europe is already cooled and starting to get rainy and things. And we have great weather right throughout. So half-term holidays in October are very popular, as they are at Easter. But any of that time is great.
The other big question is how you get there. What, can you fly direct from Ireland?
Well, at the moment, the flights are slightly restrictive from Northern Ireland. You can fly from Dublin to Agadir, which is a direct flight on Saturdays with Aer Lingus. And from Agadir, you're only 2.5 hours. So we can send a car down to pick you up from the airport if you want to come through to Marrakesh. Alternatively, if you want to fly from Belfast City, British Airways are now offering flights from Belfast direct to Marrakesh. You do stop in Gatwick, but your bags are checked right through and you buy one ticket. So you're buying your ticket directly from BA and you more or less get the Belfast leg in for free. So you're really just paying the flight from London, and the add-on is more or less free. It's really not much more expensive than going from London. And that's the way I do it when I'm coming home. I take the BA flight. You get good baggage allowance, so that helps whenever you're coming back with all your carpets and all your things from the suits. And if you book them well in advance, the flights are really reasonable. You leave City Airport in the morning around 10 o'clock and you're in the afternoon, you're in the sunshine by the pool. So that's a very doable option.
Certainly sounds like it. And if people want to find out about the different properties and the sort of holidays you offer, what's the website they have to look at?
www.boutiquesouk.com. So boutique like shop and souk, souk.com, boutiquesouk.com, all one word.
Rosina, thank you very much indeed for taking the call.
Thanks a lot, David.
You're listening to Travel Bites Radio. My name's David Gordon. You can find us online at travelbitesradio.podbean.com. You can also find us on iTunes. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Now, when it comes to my next guest, it's very hard to know where to start because he's a travel writer, he's a radio presenter, he's a journalist, he's an author, he's a handwriting analyst as well. I think it's better just to say, as we dial into Los Angeles, hello, Cash Peters.
Hello, you. I don't know why it's so complicated that I do. It just seems like I do a lot, I think. I don't really. I think it just appears that I do.
The best question, I suppose, to start with is, what is life like living in Hollywood, California?
You know, it's not what I thought. It was the most magical thing when I arrived. I've been here 14 years, I think now, almost 15 years. And it was not... I thought it would be just like being in Disneyland. That's what I thought. I'd been to Disneyland in the 80s and I thought this is like, you know, the Magic Kingdom, and that Hollywood would be the same. It's actually quite a rough place, really. And if you can survive here, then you have really done something important, because it really tests you. This is a really strange place. So yes, you have all the tourist stuff and that's all great, and you can sit in coffee bars and I don't know what's happened. Roger Daltrey will walk in, or Ozzy Osbourne will walk in, or Pamela Anderson will walk in. You know, all those sort of people will walk in. But, so you know you're in Hollywood, but it's still a very tough place to survive. And you find people come here and they're bright and they've got great teeth and lovely hair. And you just know that somebody somewhere has said, you should be in movies, or you should be on television, you should go to Hollywood. And they arrive, and a year later, they're like crusty old men. They've got huge bags under their eyes. They just weigh their disappointment on their shoulders. But generally, if you can make it here, if you can actually make your life work, there is something to be said for blue skies and sun every day. And there's something to be said for living in a place where people are upbeat and jolly and look after their health and stuff like that. It's actually a great place, but there is that huge caveat. But if you can survive long enough to enjoy it.
I mean, you were saying there about some of the celebrities. I mean, can you just walk down the street and see some of the big celebs just do the normal day-to-day stuff?
Oh, yeah. Actually, yesterday morning, I was having breakfast in a place in Santa Monica called The Firehouse. And I was sitting there and I was doing some work at my table. And I look up and there's a guy, a British guy, actually, staring at me from the next table over his agent's shoulder. His agent's got his back to me. And he's staring at me. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I know you. Where do I know you from? And it's not like school, which if I were living in England, it would be I knew you from school. This is like I know him from a TV show. And it is just like that. And if you're lucky, they're people you recognize. If you're not, that you just sort of, they seem vaguely familiar and you'll look at them for ages. I was once in a place that's now a Starbucks, but it used to be called Buzz Coffee, close to my house. And I sat there one evening and I looked up. I'm always making notes. And I looked up and Robin Williams was staring at me from across the coffee bar. And he was in this like all over one piece parachute jumpsuit or something. I don't know what he was wearing. Anyway, so he was standing there looking at me. And so I kind of looked at him and then carried on with my work. I look up and he's still looking at me. So I thought, there's something very strange going on here. And then he goes and he leaves. And I think he was just researching some part about a sad old fool sitting in a coffee bar. And I was actually research for him. But you do find that. I find that you'll be walking down the street and there will be somebody, or they'll be sitting in a car, or they'll just go. I really don't drive a car, actually. So I stand at bus stops, as sad as that is. And you know, somebody will come up to a traffic light and it'll be some famous guy sitting in a car. It's a very odd place like that, because the whole place is populated by celebrities and they're really here. They really have homes here. So you'll go to a friend's house. Like my friend lives next door to Barbara Streisand. And so over the fence is Barbara Streisand. And Barbara Streisand came over one day to her and just said, oh, I see you have a greenhouse. I want to look in your greenhouse. And I go, oh my God. It was Barbara Streisand. What happened? And she said she was very grumpy and had sciatica. It's like, oh, okay. And I went down to her house, actually, and Matthew McConaughey's brother directed me to the house. And he was like, just like, again, he's semi-naked with a surfboard. And it's like him there. And then Julia Roberts lives over there, and Kenny G lives there. It's really a phenomenal place.
Now, it would be very remiss of us not to talk about your book, which is called Force of Habit, Sister Madeleine Investigates. Where on earth did you get the inspiration for a crime-busting nun?
I used to live with a nun, actually.
Well, that's different.
But no, what happened was that I used to rent a bedsit in Golders Green in North London when I lived in London. And I had a bedsit at the back of the house, and there was one vacant at the front of the house. And one day this nun moves in called Sister Margaret. Sister Margaret Sherwood, her name was. And she was on an apostolate, which I think means that you come out of the convent and you have no clue what's in it. A bit like Maria. You're thrown out the convent and they just go, oh, you know, deal with it. And so she had no idea how to open cans of food or how to cook or what a television was. She was one of those electric kettles that stands on a stand, and she would think that was like Harry Potter type magic. And she would shriek, oh, how does it do that? I have no idea. So that stayed with me for years, and I thought there's some kind of novel in this or something. I don't know what it was. And so I eventually wrote this novel called Force of Habit, Sister Madeleine Investigates. I did the woman a great service by not naming it after her. But Sister Force of Habit, Sister Madeline Investigates. And it's about a woman who has an incredibly dark and mysterious past, who leaves the convent after about 40 years, not knowing anything about life, and has to deal with a killer, somebody who's murdering her old friends from her dark past. And I'm delighted. I put it out there thinking, I have no idea what the reception to this will be. And it's been phenomenal. I can't believe. I'm glad people love it, but I can't believe people have taken to it the way they have. I'm getting 5-star reviews. I'm getting people saying this is the most amazing thing. So, but it's really based on this character called this woman called Sister Margaret, who I lived with for a number of years, and taught how to open a can of mushrooms and things like that. It was looking back, it's one of the most eccentric parts of my life. It seemed so normal at the time, but I had this nun who would just stand there and not know how to run a bath of water, and it was really strange. But I based the book really on that, and then sort of embellished it into a kind of murder mystery.
You've been listening to Travel Bites. You can find us online at travelbitesradio.podbean.com, and you can also search for us on iTunes. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time.